Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Priskintos.
We get together here at KHOI Community Radio. We gather around the kitchen table and we talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions.
Oh, boy.
Do we ever. And I mentioned Community Radio. Be sure to support Community Radio. You can be part of this, too. This is owned by the community, owned by real people, and we depend on your good graces and good donations. If you haven't made one, do. And come to visit us here at this studio, Downtown Ames, on Douglas Avenue, under the ever-popular Ames Pantorium Historic Sign. Yes, we are on Douglas Avenue. You can find us just one block south of the public library. Well, thanks to our fine listeners, we put a call out last week. You know how it is in the spring, you just get an urge for something, and we couldn't, Donna and I couldn't find Russian tarragon.
Yeah, there's a couple of things we've been looking for, and it's a we have a member of our community, in fact, there's a few of them, who is Georgian, not the state, but the country. And Gio likes to cook a lot, and we always say, what do you eat in Georgian food? And he goes, well, one of the main issues is we don't have the right kind of tarragon around here.
Wouldn't you know it?
It has a lot of tarragon. This Russian tarragon is something we've been missing in our palette and our global culinary exploration. So Gio's a good gardener, so I kind of, we're trying to figure out how to get in some Russian tarragon. So we put a call out over the air on last show, and lo and behold, we got some responses. And I'm just going to say that Gail Hickenbaum, one of our favorite PFI members, sent two links. One of it, you can get tarragon at the Busy Bee Garden Center in Indianola, and then he sent a second one. There is more Russian tarragon at the Hy-Vee at 1990 Grand Avenue West, Ames. So yeah. I might have to hustle down there and get some.
Well, see, I didn't think to look there.
Good. I mean, if I want really, truly Georgian authentic food, I think it's worth
right.
the trip.
Right. There is French tarragon, and I have grown that. But I think Russian, just in my past experience, I think Russian tarragon is a bit hardier and grows taller and et cetera.
Yeah, my little cursory internet search said they definitely have similar flavors. The French is more delicate, and the Russian tarragon, yes, is more Russian, as it
oh,
were.
Oh, wouldn't you know.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you to our listeners, because this is Community Radio. You can help make this show
and
happen.
Thank you for your support. Once again, Gail Hickenbaum.
Yes. Good. Today, in our studio, around this very kitchen table, we have Nick Odey coming to join us. And he not only is going to tell us what's going on with Practical Farmers of Iowa, but he's going to bring us a bit of a interview that he did, and he'll tell us all about it.
And this is going to be a reoccurring feature, is it not?
It should be. Yes,
farmer
it is.
Interviews on the Donalana Kitchen. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
It's good to be able to find out where that food comes from. And Nick is going to spend the summer and a bit more interviewing farmers and telling us all about it. So, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen, Nick.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So, tell us a little bit about PFI in general and what you do there.
Well, so I'm the research and media coordinator for Practical Farmers of Iowa. And so, I write stories, I do videos, and now we are expanding into podcasts.
Woohoo!
Yeah, so starting this week, we're going to have our first episode of this new podcast called On Farm: Conversations with Practical Farmers, and that'll be available this week. And we're going to do this year is we're going to have an interview with farmers who are hosting field days this year. And so we're going to.
Yes, field days all over the state of Iowa are one of the highlights of the summer. And they're not all just technically for farmers. There are some that are of general interest to eaters and other members of our community.
That's right. We have field days that are really focused on a whole bunch of different topics growing anything, and they are focused for farmers, but there's lots of things that are very interesting to eaters.
A couple of years ago, I went to a salsa making workshop from a pepper grower somewhere south of Des Moines. It was fabulous.
There's anything we've done. We've done anything from something like that to, I know a couple years ago we did a field day at a distillery because they were using some of a
PFI
right, member's
grain. Oh,
that's right,
over on the Mississippi River. Uh-huh. So we will. There are a lot of field days, and you can find the guide on the PFI website, right?
It'll be up probably within about a month or so. We
should
have the guide.
Giddy up! Come on, it's time. It's time. And Lana and I will, if Nick reminds us, we will of course alert our listeners to ones that are potentially of interest for the more general public, and some of us who like to delve into the more slightly esoteric aspects of farming. That is, it's esoteric for non-farmers. But thank you, because Nick is now our liaison. In some senses, but with PFI.
Oh, that's a good word. Liaise for us. What have you got for us today?
Yeah, you bet. I'll tell you a little bit more about the podcast in a little bit, but I wanted to just give you a little bit of update of some of the things that are going on at Practical Farmers in the last week. So we just announced the keynote speaker for next year's conference, and that is...
I saw it. This is very exciting.
Yeah,
this is very exciting. I'm halfway through his book.
Oh, it's a great book.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah. So the conference is January 19th and 20th of next year, so make sure to put that on your calendar. And the theme is revival, and so we're going to be talking about
revival. That's a broad subject.
But specifically reviving rural communities in this case. And so we've brought in James Rebanks, who is from the Lake District of England, and he's a shepherd there.
Shepherd.
That's right.
That's right. Traditional.
Traditional shepherd, and so traditional, in fact, that his family have been raising sheep for about 600 years, his family, on the same farm.
It's amazing.
So we're excited to have him talk about what he's learned.
Do you have the name of the book there? Because I don't remember it.
Yeah, the book's called The Shepherd's Life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It is. It's a fantastic book.
It's
about
great read.
Going away from the farm and coming back, and it's just kind of a great well-told story. So he's going to be here, so make sure to get that down on your calendar.
The Shepherd's Life. Say his name again.
Yeah, James Rebanks.
Rebanks. Rebanks.
That's right. And you can find him on Twitter, too, at Herdwick Shepherd. He's got a big following on Twitter. He tweets a lot of pictures of his sheep and just...
the Twitter farmers. Oh,
yes.
Boy.
Good.
I'm old-fashioned, but the book is great to read, I have to say.
Good.
It is a great read. So... the other thing that we've just put out, one of the things is that for vegetable farming, there's two stories out there when it comes to vegetable farming. One is that you can make all this money on a tiny little bit of land, and the other is that there's no money in farming. Kind of the same thing we hear a lot. But so what we've done at Practical Farmers of Iowa, a number of farmers have shared their finances, and so we compiled those.
That is actually a very trusting and generous thing to do.
Well, they are remaining anonymous in this report, which is great. But it's really good information that allows beginning farmers to come
in
and look and see some actual numbers.
Absolutely, that is wonderful.
So that's on our website, and you can find that, again, at practicalfarmers.org. Like I said, that report, the Whole Farm Financial Report, is out now, so you can take a look at that. And then the other thing that's been on a lot of our members' minds recently is, in case maybe you haven't heard about this, but if you haven't, you should have. The Iowa legislature in its most recent session passed a bill that eliminates the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, which was crucial in getting Practical Farmers of Iowa started and has conducted research for the last 30 years on all kinds
really
of topics.
I mean, really important. Small farm, large farm, water quality. This is a big deal.
Yeah. This is a really
tragic big deal.
It is a really big deal, and at Practical Farmers, we don't ever weigh in on political issues, basically. Our membership is from all over the political spectrum, but this is one case that we can really agree on. We really urge Governor Branstad. He still hasn't signed it. He still has the opportunity to line item veto that part of the bill.
And the founding of the Leopold Center happened on his watch. This is actually one of the most sterling programs that he has shepherded during during his tenure. I mean, it really is. I don't know why he'd want to make a blow to his reputation like this.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a good opportunity for him to end his legacy kind of on a similar note that he came in on. And
right, and it really is nonpartisan for the informed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I think of it as the Leopold Center has provided all this research that allows farmers to solve conservation issues for themselves, in addition to a whole bunch of other resources, but it allows farmers to kind of independently solve those pressing issues of farming. So hopefully Governor Branstad will do the right thing and line item veto that.
And we can all send our encouragement to him through phone calls, emails. Let him know how you feel about this.
That's right.
We need this in Iowa. And it actually has been a national resource, something we should be all very proud of.
Yeah, it's definitely something for Iowa to be proud of. And as someone who was born in Burlington, Iowa, the birthplace of Aldo Leopold, it's especially important for me.
Uh-huh.
So then, finally, the next thing that we have coming up this week is we're going to be releasing a podcast. Like I said, it's called On Farm: Conversations with Practical Farmers. And the first guest that we have on is Jill Bebout, and she is a vegetable farmer in southern Iowa, and she has a CSA and
very active in farmers markets too, in the Des Moines farmers market for years.
That's right, really active in the veggie growing community and
CSA
community.
She makes a rhubarb lemonade. I want you to know that.
Oh, I wish I would have known that. I would have asked.
Ha
ha ha. Well, I still have to. So I have to find out about that.
What did you talk to Jill about?
So we talked about a number of different things, but we talked first and foremost about her field day. We did also talk about in this interview, and you'll be able to find it on our website towards the end of the week. We talked about growing vegetables in high tunnels, kind of her vision for her farm. She originally had a career in the theater industry and came back to take over her family farm.
So we talked
a little bit about that. Talked some about her alpacas. And the wool that she gets from them. But like I said,
when is her field day?
Yeah, so her field day is May 21st.
Coming right up.
From 2 to 5. It's the first PFI field day of the year.
I wonder if she's making rhubarb lemonade.
Well, I think that's probably not too late to get in a request for that. But she's going to be – her farm's down by Sheridan, Iowa, in south central Iowa, and it's called Blue Gate Farm. And what they're going to be talking about at this field day is two-wheel tractors. So these are now considered antique implements, but for small vegetable farms, this is a great technology. And she's going to be talking about that.
Can you explain what is it, like a bicycle that digs? I mean, what is it?
Well, actually, we have a little clip from the interview with Jill, and she explains some of that a little bit in the little preview to the podcast coming up. So, what is a two-wheeled tractor?
a two-wheeled tractor will look to most people like the front end of a normal garden tiller, say. Or if you're familiar with the BCS tillers that a lot of us use, it would be the front, the mechanical portion of that, or the driver part of that, the power unit, as it were. They're a traditional tool. They were used. They're still used in Europe a great deal. They were used in the United States, mainly 20s through the early 60s were really their high point. And it provided small farmers with a power unit that drove any number of implements. And home gardeners used them. They were marketed to home gardeners as well as small market farmers.
And so why is that important on your farm today?
For us, it's still a little bit of a new venture for us. We really just started getting into them about a year ago, so we're still we're still discovering a great deal of how they're going to play a role on our farm. But we are a fairly small farm. We've got a total of 6 acres in vegetables, including high tunnels. And given the lay of our land, we're fairly hilly. We're on permanent bed systems in most of our fields. So I don't have wide open tracks that make it easy to cultivate mechanically. So most of what we've been doing has been manual, lots of hands and knees work, lots of wheel hoes and stirrup hoes. And as I'm not getting any younger, I like to work farther from the ground. So a little less hands and knees work. This gives us the ability in very small areas to have a mechanical advantage and certainly have a speed advantage. It allows us to work much more quickly and efficiently, but at a fairly reasonable economic impact on our farm. The very first unit that we bought, which unfortunately was minus a motor, so it was lacking some things, but we found it at an auction, bought the body and a whole handful of implements for $35. So that was a pretty easy hit for the farm. And then we spent a fair amount of time, you know, messing around with coming up with a motor for it. But to date, I believe we've spent under $300. We have 3 working units of different sizes and a full complement of tooling for them, everything from different types of cultivators. We've got a couple different gang discs. We've got spike tooth harrows and reel mowers and deck mowers and a snow blower. And so there's lots and lots of flexibility of implements that are available with these tools. And they're out there in people's old tree patches and equipment rows. And they're kind of a tool of yesterday that is still a really useful tool for us today that I think a lot of small farmers just don't know is out there. And they were so incredibly well made. The implements and the equipment are made at the same grade that tractor, full-size tractor implements are made of. So it's heavy gauge steel and, you know, old hardened steel bolts that are still very manageable to put back to use today.
So where do you find these?
Auctions seems to be the hot location for them, but they pop up on Craigslist. They pop up on eBay. Auction seems to be, unless you get into a collector's type auction, auctions is definitely the cheapest place to run into them. You kind of have to have an idea of what you're looking for. So that's one of the big pushes for us to do the field day, is to help people see what's out there, because I guess you can't know to look for it if you don't know it exists, and to just give people kind of an introduction into, you know, these are out there and they're well worth keeping an eye out for.
So for veggie farmers out there, what might this replace on the farm? I know you said that it kind of helps save some backbreaking labor a little bit, but what are some of the tools that this is a step up from?
Sure. I would say it's definitely wheel hoes or hand hoeing by any means. But it's kind of like, if you're using the cultivator, it's kind of like having a powered wheel hoe or a power assisted wheel hoe. So definitely replaces hand hoes, wheel hoes. Also possibly some people use like the 3-tine cultivators and things like that to break crust on the soil. Definitely would replace those. Allows us to put less pressure on the soil. I mean, I have a larger disc that goes on our full size tractor, but this allows me to work in a much smaller space, so I don't need turnaround space, and it's not as space hungry as if I'm trying to use the larger mechanical tools. So if you look at it that way, you know, it also allows you to replace some big equipment. But if you have the mowing attachments for it, it certainly can replace weed whackers and lawn mowers and I guess a snow blower if you have your snow blower attachment.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the plans for the field day. It's May 21st, is that right?
That sounds correct. Yep, Sunday the 21st. And the plan is that mostly I am opening up our farm and have conned a very good friend of mine who is one of really considered one of the leaders in the nation as far as small antique agricultural tools. And as far as the two-wheel tractors or walkers, as they sometimes call them, he's really one of the nationwide experts. And I was very lucky to connect with him sometime in the past, and he lives in Columbus Junction. So we're lucky that he's relatively local, and he is going to pack up a big chunk of his collection and trailer them over to our place for the day. So people will be able to see the small collection I have, but also his very extensive collection of many more brands and types and sizes of these units, as well as a pretty extensive collection of implements that can be used with them. We're hoping, if the weather will cooperate, that people will actually be able to get hands-on on some of these tools and put them in the soil, see how they feel. The advantage for someone like me, I'm not a particularly large human being, so having great big awkward equipment can be a problem for me. And so I want, you know, people who aren't 6.5 foot tall, 300-pound men to know that this is equipment that is completely sized for everyone, and be able to put their hands on it and see that it's not a scary or intimidating piece of equipment.
How about in terms of mechanical know-how? I mean, how complex are they to fix in comparison with something like a small engine or also like an old tractor?
Sure. I would say they can take a bit of mechanical knowledge. A lot of it depends on if you're working with an original motor, and a lot of them still have original motors that are running, or if you've put a new motor on it. So, you know, having a little mechanical knowledge, or at least having a certain comfort level with small engines, lawnmower-style engines, is very helpful. But as long as either you have that or you have access to, you know, a lawnmower guy or a small engine guy or someone that has that information, there's a lot of assistance online. The communities of people who are involved with these machines are very engaged and very willing to share and talk. So it's been a very educational process for me as well. And so we're happy to share that with other people too, because the more of us who are interested in revitalizing this part of agricultural mechanics, I think the more vibrant and potentially the more interested companies will be in starting to produce new tooling for items like this.
That was Jill Bebout of Blue Gate Farm near Sheridan, Iowa. And like she said, she's hosting a field day on May 21st from 2 to 5. You can find more information about that field day on our website at practicalfarmers.org. You can get directions and a little bit more info on the farm.
Do you need to register in advance or not?
I don't think so for this one. You can check out all the details, but I don't think you need to RSVP because I don't think there's any food, but maybe she'll make the rhubarb lemonade if we get a note to her.
Okay.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you. Nick Odie brought us that wonderful, wonderful bit of information about small-scale tools. I have a huge interest in that sort of thing. Hose and wheel hose, I would be glad to replace with something a bit heftier. Thank you. So we're going to be hearing more from Nick in future shows because he's going to keep us up on what's happening on the farm with more Farm Talk.
Thank you, Nick.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to KHOI 89.1, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was some fine, locally grown Iowa fiddle music from fiddler Al Murphy. Al Murphy is one of those local treasures. He lives over in the Iowa City area, has played fiddle music with various dance bands and bluegrass bands for years and years. He and Alita are fine people. His wife Alita plays backup, bass, and guitar, and he gathers a fine bunch of people around him. So, and that tune was called Through the Fields. Well, fields. Yes, they're greening up and the farmers market season is starting up in parking lots all over the state and on streets and heaven knows where. People are showing up and showing their wares, and we had a dandy opening day for farmers market this past weekend. It was just the most beautiful Saturday you've ever seen, and it was wonderful. Lovely people out, kind of still kind of pale from their winter lack of sun, but we were squinting at each other and enjoying each other. And the farmers market that happens downtown Ames this last Saturday, they celebrated with a food truck festival, and there were I don't know, a dozen more
lovely food trucks. Lovely weather and a good crowd turnout.
Good crowd, good food. Food trucks were there and vendors.
And there were even some farmers.
There were in between everything else. But it was a good day to meet everybody, and what a good start to Farmers Market. Donna's got some news here about something coming up
at the Farmers Market.
There we go.
All right. We are having, and the event will actually become public on May 20th at the Farmers Market on May 20th. We are having a lard baking contest.
Now, that ought to trip your trigger, Donna. We've talked about lard before on this show.
I got so excited.
So, what did you find out, Donna?
Well, it seems that, what is that, Lucky George Farm? Is that the one?
Mm-hmm.
Which sells lard, incidentally, from their non-GMO pastured pigs, very fine product. There are several farmers at the market that sell lard. Remnant Hills also sells lard. But this was the idea of the Lucky George Farm. So you can grab an entry form. Lana grabbed one for me because she knew I would be interested. You can also get lard this next weekend, which will be the 13th. Or you can, you can supply your, there are other places to buy lard too, but this is really good lard that we have at our farmer's market. So get an entry form, and you have to put in the name of the recipe and all of that sort of thing. And I guess the judging will be on the 20th. And we, of course, will be sticking our noses into all of this and getting some good descriptions and possibly some good recipes. And we may have a mystery contestant that will just have to enter something lard baked, because we really like that.
We like lard. And it always brings up, pie crust. Pie crust is something that people have opinions on, and
it's the classic.
There should be
some good pies, and there should be some good other things. We've got a couple of lard recipes on our website, don't we? I think we do.
There is. You can go there.
Yes, so the lard baking contest at the Ames Farmers Market will be May 20th.
Yes, get more information at the Ames Farmers
Market. Now, this
is
not lard cooking. This is baking.
Baking,
okay.
Yes. And you also found at the Farmers Market.
Oh, chervil, yes. Okay, so we had talked about Lee's Greens is growing chervil, and I am chirping over the chervil, but I seem to be the only one in town, because she said they're not selling very much of it because people don't know what it is.
So tell us.
Okay, I'm going to be a little more specific. I think the last time I mentioned it, I just said, oh, it's wonderful. You can use it for anything. And apparently, that was not specific enough. So I'm going to read you a little bit from the Herb Farm Cookbook. This is an Oregon chef who really the main point of the garden, of the restaurant is the garden, and they pick right from the garden. So he says, this is, Jerry Trownfield, very well known, highly respected chef. I love his work. Under his Chervil section, he says, everything about Chervil is delicate. The flavor is subtle and only hints of anise and parsley. Its leaves are thin, soft, and gentle green color, and it is very frail. It resembles its cousin parsley, and it is a short-lived annual that looks like a lacy fern. It's a close friend to tarragon, but you have to... It says, naturally, this delicate herb is best paired with delicate foods. So he does mention, you know, like for cooking, and I forgot to emphasize this, you don't throw it in the pot, in the stew pot, and let it cook for hours. It's just something you add only at the very, very end of the cooking, and you can use it very generously. It's great in salads, sprinkled on an omelet.
Well, it seems like the kind of thing you would sprinkle over deviled eggs.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. He says use chervil with abandon, but finely minced teaspoon will get you nowhere. So use lots of it. Use a tablespoon to a quarter cup for 6 servings, but don't put it in something that's going to get a lot of heat. It's really particularly wonderful with, like, fish, shellfish, something, you know, that already has a very delicate flavor. And it's a garnishing herb. First of all, it's very, very pretty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I want to encourage people to buy the chervil at the farmer's market because then they'll grow more.
Just like we heard with the two-wheel tractor information. If more people use it, then the producers of two-wheel tractors will perk up and take notice. And that'll happen
exactly
with the
right.
farmers, too.
And it's not an easy herb to buy in a non-urban area. And I guess we could try growing it.
Yeah, I have tried. It's a tricky thing to start because, like parsley, it takes a long time for the little things to come up. And because it's so wonderfully delicate, there it sits.
Yeah, you need a lot of it.
Yeah, and you need a lot of it.
Yeah,
so
you do.
I have grown it, and it does, yes, it grows like parsley. And so that it does work. But, again, those that can grow it in quantity – fantastic.
Well, Lise Greens, she's also selling plants. So as an insurance policy, I bought 2 of them and then I put them in the garden. And then I read the book that said, oh, they really like cooler, more shady places. So, and they don't like to move. So I'm actually going to have to go out, dig them up and move them.
Go ahead and move them. I mean, I do that.
They've only been in 24 hours. I figure
I
how bad
that
can
too.
It be?
I change my mind and I move things around. Just talk to them
and
nicely.
They really are pretty.
Yes.
They're pretty on the plate. They're pretty in the garden. And you can get all your nice green minerals from, I'm big on, herbs are a vegetable, you know, in a lot of ways. They count towards all the good things that your body needs to eat.
Good. So good chervil.
Chervil.
That's C-H-E-R-V-I-L, chervil. I would like to talk about some other things. I'm going to kind of take us into the pink, the magenta part of the color spectrum here. There's a lot of things after a kind of a bland winter. Here we are with green, and pink things start happening. Pink things, magenta things, red things. One of the things that is extremely pink and extremely red, and we've mentioned this before, is rhubarb. And I want to just mention this because a really fine young man named Rick Morrison came up to me the other day and gave me this book, and I've been enjoying it. It's a dictionary of culinary terms and a dictionary of culinary ingredients. It's called A Food Lover's Companion.
It's a fabulous book. I've had one on my desk for years.
I'm the kind of person that likes to read dictionaries, too. So anyway, I looked up rhubarb. Believe it or not, rhubarb is in the buckwheat family. Who would have known? Buckwheat family. And if you let rhubarb go to seed, yeah, there's this big kind of seedy thing at the top.
It stalks right up.
It's stuck, yeah. Now, that they have pink stalks, red stalks, sometimes green stalks. It says in here, in olden days, or maybe even in specialty markets, they can actually grow rhubarb in a hothouse all year round.
Yeah, I think that was a Victorian specialty of exotic vegetables. They did it to endive, asparagus, rhubarb.
Mm-hmm. It seems it'd be hardy enough. And that rhubarb is decidedly extremely pink and delicate. But we are more used to the really, really hefty red stuff. So that's good.
Well, and there's also a lot of just, frankly, green. My rhubarb arrives from different sources around, and I cook it down, and it's not red at all. It's kind of green.
Oh, we like rhubarb, and we'll talk more about rhubarb later. So some more pink things. Some more pink things. Poison ivy. It's very red. I think this is going to be a good poison ivy year because
good for the poison ivy.
Okay. As I'm kind of trolling my way through the woods trying to find the last of the morel mushrooms and whatever other nice pretty things are out there, I notice there's these little red, droopy little, pointy little heart-shaped leaves kind of coming up all over the place.
And clusters of three, right?
Clusters of three. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. And I've been on this planet long enough, and I've gotten into poison ivy enough that I can recognize it at 100 paces. I really can. But I found out a few things about it. Despite its name, it is not an ivy. It's a poison ivy.
Poison ivy, too, here.
Poison ivy. Poison ivy is not an ivy. It is a member of the cashew or almond family, which means that if you have a really bad reaction to poison ivy, you probably better be careful of cashews and almonds because they're kind of related. Yes. And you think the poison ivy is out to get us, right? Oh, it doesn't like us. It's putting up these poisons. Well, really, the compound in the poison ivy sap is not a defensive measure at all. It helps the plant to retain water. And it just so happens that it doesn't sit with us very well at all. So some of these little rhymes can help you identify the thing. So you already mentioned leaves of three, let it be, poison ivy. A hairy vine, no friend of mine. Huh? because leaves of three, they're a small box elder trees have leaves of three as they come up. But those are trees. And maybe some other things. But if it's got a hairy vine, no friend of mine. And in the fall, berries white, run in fright. Oh, I'll do that. I sort of have a reaction. Just, I've learned to stay away from it. And here
have you ever tried eating the leaves, Lana?
Oh, good heavens, no.
Oh, okay, here's some folk wisdom, and I have some experience with it.
Oh.
My son Arian, when he was growing up in California, we don't have poison ivy, we had poison oak. Very similar, but different. Mm-hmm. Same thing, it's, you know, and he was forever scrambling through the woods, and the dog would run out and bring it home and all that sort of thing. And so Arian was highly allergenic, and it was suggested to us by a very clever neighbor that if he eats, I can't remember, a leaf or two with some frequency, and if this is useful to anybody, I will get the information. You eat a very small amount over a short period of time, you know, like a month or something, and it reduces your reaction to it a lot.
Well, for goodness sakes.
I know.
Unless you're allergic to cashews, be careful because you won't
well,
be.
Well, I'll find out, Lana, so you can experiment with it.
No, thank you. I know enough to stay away from these. One more pink thing for spring. Pink thing. It's kind of coming to the end, but this central Iowa has a lot of a tree called the eastern redbud.
And beautiful
pink,
it
pink,
is.
Pink, pink, magenta,
oh,
magenta.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's lovely. The buds are kind of going away now. But if you catch those buds at the right time, enjoy that pink. It is a member of the pea family. It is a legume, believe it or not.
So is it nitrogen fixing?
I think so because, let me guess, that it would be because things like honey locusts are also... They have pods. They are nitrogen fixing.
Oh, goody.
Yes, good. And the red bud flowers are edible, and as are the young seeds.
I didn't know that.
I got myself together, and I went out, and I harvested some red bud blossoms, which is really easy because you just there's so many all at once.
Oh, they're beautiful in the jar too, I have to tell you. Yeah. They look like a perfect potpourri. How did you dry these?
In a food dryer.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you actually put them in the dehydrator.
Yeah, because, you know, there they
She's
sit.
She's the dehydrator queen. Amazing.
It worked. And I hear tell you can bake with them, but you can also.
Now, when you bake with them, does the color stay baking?
Yeah, well,
is it flavor? Or what do we,
like? We're going for flavor here because the flavor is.
I'm going to stick one in my mouth here.
It's a little citrusy. It's a little bittery, and I'm going to use it in tea. It says it's good in tea. You can pickle or cook the buds, but
I'm getting the little it's later in the it hits your tongue.
Mm-hmm. It says, regarding the flowers, the light-colored upper part of the blossom is sweet. The lower part is bitter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a personal choice. And as an herb, it treats colds, flu and fever, and congestion. So there it is. I mean, here's this burst of magenta. And you could actually do things with it this time of year. And
I have to say, I think that the blossoms are so lovely. If you had them freeze-dried and you wanted to, like, sprinkle them on the top of a birthday cake or something frosting. It's quite decorative.
I'm very surprised at how the colors stay.
I think
so
it's
magenta,
really
magenta.
Lovely.
Pink
a
things.
A new edible flower for me.
Pink things. This is KHOI 89.1. This is Community Radio. Support this fine station. Back. Pink things this time of year. Donna, talk about rhubarb some more. We just can't get enough.
Well, while Lana's waxing rhapsodically about the pink things, I just have a little practical something you can do with it. This is the simplest thing that I do with rhubarb. It's an old one. Rhubarb upside down cake. I'm just going to talk you through it. You butter a cake pan heavily. You slice some rhubarb into it till it's kind of covered. You sprinkle that with sugar, depending on how sweet you want it. And then you take any old quick cake, yellow cake, white cake. And I was thinking today, I might even try it with a chocolate cake. You just pour the batter over the top of the rhubarb and then bake it. And bake it till it's done, you know.
That's how it works. Yeah.
That's right. And then when you take it out, it's your regular upside down cake. Be sure to butter well the pan before you put the rhubarb in. Maybe even butter and flour. I would have to try it again. But you want it to not stick so that when you invert it on the plate, you know, you put the plate on top of the pan, you flip the whole thing over, it comes out speckled on the top with the rhubarb and kind of caramelized. So what could be simpler than that?
Yay, rhubarb. And speaking of recipes, you can go to the Donna Lana Kitchen website, khoyfm.org. And there's our past shows there. There's a recipe page. And actually, there's also a recipe from a past Ames resident. She's no longer with us. But Bernice Donovan gave us a fine recipe. It's called Bernice's Really Good Rhubarb Dessert. And it's there, khoyfm.org.
Yeah, another passing that I wanted to mention this week, I went to a memorial service up in Clear Lake for Phyllis Willis, who was the great all-time Iowa farm wife with a sense of humor. And she was the wife of Paul Willis. And Paul and Phyllis founded the pork
part of Nyman Ranch. So they had, still have, a farm up in, what is that little, Thornton, up in Thornton, where they took, I think, almost 200 acres and converted it to prairie. You know, some of it had tile lines that had to be pulled out. Some of it was already still existing prairie, you know, and they let the potholes come back. And they also up there have an old schoolhouse that they'd renovated to live in, and they call it the Dream Farm. So a lot of sort of culinary celebrities would come and visit Paul and Phyllis because of the Nyman Ranch product, which was is sold a lot to very more high-end restaurants. And so Paul told this story at the memorial service. Now, Phyllis was a very clever, funny, charming woman. So he tells this story, which is so Iowan. So Steve Ells, who's the founder of Chipotle, and I admire his work because he is one of the only people who have successfully taken the fast food model and modified it into something healthy. They do use a lot of Nyman Ranch pork in their burritos and whatever, and we have one here in Ames. So Steve Ells is a rather brilliant fellow, but he does zip around. So he had come to visit Paul and Phyllis, and Steve is a person that flies in on his private jet and probably hangs around about 30 seconds and flies out on his private jet. He is a busy, busy man. So Paul told this story. When Steve Ells came to visit, he looks around at the Dream Farm and he goes, "Oh, it is so beautiful here. It's really, really lovely. But what do you do for entertainment?" So Paul says, "Well, you never know what Phyllis is going to say." So she quips up, "Well, last night Paul and I were out and we saw an albino gopher." There we go. That's the entertainment in Iowa.
Big doings on the prairie. Yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic.
We like our big doings, I have to say.
I hope he was impressed. That's good. We have, I have a little poem here. And Mother's Day is coming up, and we think of food. We think of women traditionally in that role.
Slaving away in the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this kind of deals with that. Maybe we aren't always happy campers when we're cooking. And,
Yeah, if it's forced, expected, and especially if it's not appreciated.
Right. So this is a poem by Marge Percy, and it's called, "What's That Smell in the Kitchen?" All over America, women are burning dinners. It's lamb chops in Peoria, haddock in Providence. It's steak in Chicago, tofu delight in Big Sur, red beans and rice in Dallas. All over America, women are burning food they're supposed to bring with a calico smile on platters glittering like wax. Anger sputters in her brain pan, confined but spewing out missiles of hot fat. Carbonized despair presses like a clinker from a barbecue against the back of her eyes. If she wants to grill anything, it's her husband spitted over a slow fire. If she wants to serve him anything, it's a dead rat with a bomb in his belly, ticking like the heart of an insomniac. Her life is cooked and digested, nothing but leftovers in Tupperware. "Look," she says, "once I was roast duck on your platter with parsley, but now I am Spam." Burning dinner is not incompetence, but war.
Okay, so for Mother's Day, remember, don't mess with Mama.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Ooh. Don't mess with Mama.
Lady with that. That was a poem called "What's That Smell in the Kitchen?" from Marge Percy.
Yes, do remember to thank your mothers. Do something appropriately appreciative that's not redolent of Hallmark cards. I mean, it's good to have a moment of genuine gratitude on Mother's Day.
How about doing the dishes? I like that.
Oh, even better. Make the whole dinner and invite her over.
Make the whole dinner.
You know?
Yes. Yes.
Now that I no longer have a mother, actually, I had a fine mother, a wonderful, wonderful mother. I am so grateful for the mothering in my life.
Me too. We learned a lot from our moms. That's very good.
Lana, what was your mother's maiden name?
Kaun, K-A-U-N.
What was
Kaun.
Her first name?
Dorothy.
Dorothy Kaun.
Yes.
And mine was Jatty Wilkinson.
Oh, very good. Here's a salute. Here's a salute to Dorothy Jatty. Good, good. Happy Mother's Day to everybody out
And be
there.
Sure to make it happy.
Yeah. Give her something pink.
Yes. Happy mothers are a good thing.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Today, we talked about two-wheel tractors with Nick Odie from PFI. And Nick Odie is going around all summer and interviewing and recording talks with farmers.
Yep, we're going to have a regular Nick Odie feature here on the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Yeah, it's good to find out where our food comes from. So thanks to Nick for that. And he will be back in future episodes from Practical Farmers of Iowa. We'll talk about field days, and we'll talk about what's going on the farm. Last week, Donna and I heard the Barn Owl Band, a local band here in concert.
Oh, yippee boy. They rocked.
Oh, they rocked. Among other fine tunes. It was at the library
on a gorgeous day, but it was worth being inside for them. It was great.
Good music. Among other fine tunes they played is a version of this traditional Finnish waltz. It's called Metaskutskia, which is Finnish, and I'm probably not saying that right. It means flowers of the forest. And this is a version recorded by the band the Southside Swedes from Chicago. Yes. And thinking of pink things in the forest, oh yes, all the flowers, the rhubarb, the poison ivy, and the redbud trees.
It's all out there now. It's just gorgeous. It's lush. We're springing sprung here.
Thanks for joining us today. My name is Lana Nakiga.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.